Hello everyone. Today I want to tackle quite a difficult topic, which is the question of to what extent does Israel, as mentioned by John Mearsheimer in a very famous book, The Israel Lobby, control US foreign policy? Does it occupy the American government? This is a kind of commonplace belief online. On both the left and the right, and it has become only more commonplace as events have unfurled, and various high-profile people who have very good foreign policy takes, like Brian Beletic of New Atlas, vehemently deny this, as too does the editor of the Islander magazine, a chap called Rory, who I've met. Very intelligent guy. He's the editor of The Islander, which is a great publication, which you should buy. He also wrote a piece denying this. Now, I should mention that before we get going, my view on this is actually not a classic one. For example, I think that Mearsheimer, he wrote this book back in 2008, many details or many aspects of the picture in 2008 have changed. Now in 2026. I also think that there are some gradations of granular detail that are necessary. So, I mean, there are a lot of people who actually want to expand it. They want to expand it beyond the Israel lobby, and they want to actually say, this is just a problem with, like, Jewish people in general, okay, and isn't like an international conspiracy. I guess you might call it classic anti-Semitism. I've never really gone in for that either. It is not that you don't get organized groups, because you do. In fact, as we speak now, the ADL has convened a meeting called the J7, which is a task force of diaspora Jewish people meeting to combat anti-Semitism around the world as we speak. Okay, and you could say, well, here is clear evidence of organization. And they're actually, talking about the rules that should govern our countries, what you can say and what I can say and, you know, what you're allowed to say. They're meeting in Australia, where, in fact, free speech has been curtailed, as a result of the political influence and organization of some of these groups. So it is, you know, again, to quote Dickie Spencer, there's a there. But does it tell the whole story? Is it the only story? Is this the actual guiding principle of America as a country, of an American foreign policy, or is it something else? And we're going to be trying to answer this question I'm going to give a live analysis of Brian Beletic, one of his recent videos, and then I'm going to go through this essay. This could take a while, guys. That's why I've got the cigar here. Could take a while. But before we get to all of that, I think I should probably give my take, which is that, there are always competing groups and there are always, you know, various different factions of elites. But it strikes me that the current people who we tend to call Zionists, and I've mentioned this before, the people in and around Donald Trump, for example, and the people who are loyal to Netanyahu in Israel itself, are not the same as the old-fashioned neocon foreign policy establishment. They are not the same as the people who were around George W. Bush back then. And this small detail often gets overlooked, I think. Benjamin Netanyahu's party is called Likud. And there's also this much kind of, I think Tucker Carlson recently talked about another organization or another tendency, I guess, called Chabad, which I think was known as a charity group at some time or other. But it's clear to me that there's a difference, right? There's a difference between your Ben Shapiro and your Laura Luma and your Douglas Murray now, and the old-fashioned neocons of the Victoria Nuland stripe, Robert Kagan, who was a very prominent neocon theoretician back in the day, or your Wolfowitz, or any of that kind of old crew. And my basic idea with Trump is that, my basic idea with how to pass what's going on at the moment, is that whatever arrangements existed back in the day, back then, whatever the situation has been in America up until this point, something has gone rogue, okay? Something has gone off the script with this Iran war and also with Israel. That Israel itself has, so to speak, left the reservation, left the normal order of things, and has become, in and of itself, an exception, okay? And then within that, they have captured the Trump presidency, and that Trump himself and the Trump admin has become almost a kind of, whether through it compromat or through the fact that, you know, he is just part of this network or whatever other reason, that there's something that with this current war and with the current actions of this administration that are in some way not regime sanctioned. And this has been very clear through line in my analysis. And this has become clear as events have come in. One of the things I want to stress is that my view is always empirical. That is based on the facts of what actually happens. What are the facts of what has actually happened? Well, against all normal political incentives and constraints and considerations of popularity and polls and geostrategic interest and global economy and America's positioning vis-a-vis its allies and even conventional military wisdom, against all of those things, America has decided to attack Iran and kill the Ayatollah. That, you know, and it's gone against basically all of the norms. They've broken every single convention that of a world order that was upheld by America. Okay, that literally the American order, and now this is being upended for a war that many people are saying is reckless and has not been properly planned. As we'll see, this is not Brian Blettick's view, and it may not be Rory's view either, but it is my view. My view is that whatever existed beforehand, now there's some element there that has made a bid for supremacy, that Netanyahu has been on maneuvers and is making a bid for something else, and that something else is the Greater Israel Project, and it is envisions a world, a Greater Israel without America one day. But it's actually just using America to try to gain its ends, regardless of what actually existed beforehand. You could say that the architecture that was, you know, built up by the Israel lobby and the special kind of privileges within the American system that was granted by all of this and the neocons and so on and so forth has given Netanyahu a fantastic cover to continue his quite separate plans and bid for Israeli autonomy. Okay. And this, I think, is a key thing to distinguish between what was before and what is now, and how we don't live in a static world where it's always 1995 or always 2008. We live in a developing world, and we have to update our conclusions based on the results that come in, based on what comes in. Okay. So, and we'll go into all of the reasons why it's obvious that even if there was some plan back in the 90s, or if there was some plan in 2007, 2008, no plan survives contact with reality. And the only way really to make sense of events is the version that I have just given you, that some element of this has gone rogue, that the permanent US regime is not really for this, that the globalist regime is not really for this, that all the NATO generals and so on are not for this. And the more we get, the more you focus in on those specifics, the more the Brian Blesik view that all of the disagreements that we see between America and its allies, okay, which are very public, like he maintained it's all Punch and Judy, it's all theater, okay? I'm saying it's real. The more you have to explain away events that are inexplicable with what is in effect speculation, the more it appears to be conspiratorial, okay? Don't forget, we have been told by Marco Rubio and by Donald Trump directly to camera and personally that this war is happening as a result of advice given by Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff. Those are the facts, okay? Those are the actual facts of the matter. We are 17 days into this war, and it still looks like America has not planned for the way this, like the specifics of how this is planning out. But Blesik maintains they're working according to plans that were drawn up in 1996, a plan called Breaking Away. I think actually the blueprint was devised in 2007, 2008. I think the problem for Blesik's analysis and for people who maintain this view is that if you're using old plans, the intelligence has changed and the war has changed. The relative strengths and weaknesses of America and Iran have changed. The circumstances have changed. You can't just dust off old plans and expect them still to work now. And I think my explanation explains all sorts of things, like the curious, anachronistic attempt to bring Reza Pahlavi, okay, back on to the throne in Iran. Okay, this, that moment was then. The moment for it was in 2008, 2009, possibly even, I remember there were, you know, the regime was particularly unpopular in around 2010, 2011, around the time of the Arab Spring. Okay, those plans did exist. Blesik is right that they had plans, okay? But these people now, Netanyahu and the government around him, and Trump and the government around him, are not simply a continuity agenda with all of that. It's obvious to me, looking at what is happening, looking at how it's playing out in the media, considering the way in which there was absolutely no attempt to manufacture consent, okay, in the media, the way that a British establishment, NATO establishment, American establishment, even figures like Robert Kagan now, are saying that Israel is a strategic liability, are saying that there was no plan, are saying that we are not for this, are questioning the relationship with America, the fact that Foreign Policy magazine, Regime Central, is saying there's no strategic insight here and there is no reason to do this right now. All of those things to me suggest that whatever this is, whether America succeeds or fails, is rogue. It was not decided upon or agreed with the normal channels of power. It has happened outside of it. That explains all sorts of things. Like, who are, like, at what other time have you had weird non-government figures like Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff conducting, I mean, literally two Jewish guys with strong pro-Zionist tendencies, basically negotiating on behalf of America, okay, with no diplomatic training or anything. They're just mates of Trump's. When have we ever had that before? Where was that in the 1996 plan, Brian? Or where was that in the 2008 plan? Okay, this is, I mean, maybe all of these politicians and so on don't say anything about it because they've been paid by AIPAC or whatever. I mean, it gives Netanyahu cover. But what I'm saying is there's actually a divergence between the permanent neocon foreign policy establishment and what is happening here. I believe this war was Israel's war. This was Netanyahu's plan, and that Trump, and I'm sure this will come out in the fullness of time, is executing an Israeli plan that is not in American interests. Okay, that is my view. Let's see how it stacks up against the Brian Bolesik view and the view from Rory. Okay, before we get going on this, I'm already 15 minutes in. Do buy Foundations of Shakespeare. It is out today. Today. Released. 10th book by Dr. Parvini, and he's returned to Shakespeare. Pick up the course Foundations of Writing. You pick up Foundations of Writing, but pick up the course Foundations of Shakespeare and send the receipt to the publisher and they'll give you 50% off. It has to be that one, though. I would recommend getting Foundations of Writing, but if you send them the receipt for that, they'll say, sorry, it's still full price. It has to be Foundations of Shakespeare. You send them the receipt, they'll give you half the money off. Okay, let us take this away. It is going to be Brian Bolesik, first of all. We're going to watch. I don't know how much of this video we're going to get through, but I want to see what his counter argument is here. Okay, I will mute myself and spark up this cigar, and then in the time honored fashion, pause, Brian.
Ask you a question. Do you think
to, you know, interject? So I'm going to let me just mute myself here. So I can relight this beautiful Partagas cigar.
The truth is most important, or your pride, your ego, and your emotions? It's an important question to ask, and it's an important question to honestly answer. And if you answered the truth, and you really...
So, right, it is an important question. And on this channel, I'm dedicated to what the truth is. Okay, not trying to fit the world into a pre-existing pattern. But the question I want to ask you is, am I, you know, that spiel, that 50-minute spiel I gave you, am I drawing conclusions from the facts? Okay, or do I have a pre-existing narrative and then try to fit the fact to that conclusion? And then now ask yourself the same question of Brian here. Does he have a pre-existing thesis that he's trying to fit to the world into that pattern, okay? Or is he updating his analysis to fit new facts? Let's carry out this Foundations of Logic, people, okay? But this is called inductive reasoning versus deductive reasoning. Let's let him continue.
I mean it, then please keep that in mind as I continue, because I'm going to say things that are going to offend your ego, your pride, and ruffle your emotions, most certainly. I posted this recently. People claiming Israel controls the U.S. are either delusional or dishonest. And I'm primarily talking about people that pose as experts that are spreading this narrative around. Almost every single one of these people are the same people who told you last year that President Donald Trump and his administration were coming in to save America and save the world. They were leading a revolution. They were fighting the deep state. They were going to...
Now, he's right about all of this. He's calling out lots of people, and you could probably include Tucker Carlson in this as well. He is calling out people who cheerleaded Trump and now feel betrayed by him. This much is true. Let's see where else he goes, but let's give Brian credit where it's due. These people did cheerlead Trump, and now they're saying they're betrayed by him and are blaming Israel for it. That's true.
Work together with multipolarism and usher in a bright new future for us all. They were 100% wrong about that. I told people at the time that they were, that the Trump administration was going to obediently serve continuity of agenda. And they were going to make everything far worse than it already was. And I was very specific about it too. It wasn't a vague warning. I told people it's going to take the war in Ukraine, dump it on the Europeans. It's going to escalate out of control, which it is. He's going to then take the resources that they are going to focus elsewhere and first start war with Iran and then China. And that is exactly what they have done. And I warned people.
It is true that Brian Bolesik predicted all of these things. And it is also true that the so-called Israel lobby and that the original neocons and that Hillary Clinton and the permanent foreign policy establishment in America has been signaling war with Iran since the Axis of Evil speech back in 2003, given by George W. Bush. And they were really gearing up for a war with Iran around 2007, 2008. Barack Obama coming in actually put the kibosh on a lot of that sort of talk. But then Hillary Clinton was particularly bellicose with her anti-Iran rhetoric at various different times. So anyway, let's carry on.
Before the first war of aggression against Iran last year, and they warned people again this year, there was no diplomacy. They were always bent on going to war. Nobody is twisting their arm to go to war. It was a foregone conclusion before President Trump even stepped foot into office. It was a war that the Biden administration was already preparing the ground for. All 4 years in office, the Trump administration before that, and going all the way back to the Bush administration. I explained in detail how the whole Arab Spring.
Yeah, true, but also, why didn't any previous president pull the trigger on it? It was a plan, but those plans were shelved. And I think that this aspect of what Brian is saying is true, that those plans were there, the blueprint was there. And I believe that the reason that this current war is so chaotic and so shambolic from the American point of view is that they've simply took those plans off the shelf, dusted them off, maybe updated it with a bit of AI gubbins, and run the script. That's why it looks so bad. So I agree with that part of analysis. What I don't agree with necessarily is whether any of these other presidencies, even the Biden one, would have done this, because not one of them had been well and truly captured by Netanyahu in the way that the Trump presidency appears to be. Okay, I remember the Biden administration and the figure of Antony Blinken. Okay, now Antony Blinken, okay, is Jewish, and Antony Blinken, you know, has long ties to Israel. But Antony Blinken is not a figure, a weird quasi a kind of non-official figure like Jared Kushner or Steve Witkoff, okay, doing business outside the normal protocols. Antony Blinken is not like, there are all, like, the Biden White House didn't have a nutter like Mike Huckabee running around as the ambassador to Israel, like using biblical language and justifications. The Biden White House didn't have a figure like Pete Hegseth there, okay, literally issuing orders to U.S. troops that this is, you know, you're doing this for Jesus or whatever, okay? You didn't have a situation where, you know, Laura Loomer kind of dobbing in Tucker Carlson to the DOJ gets him investigated, and, you know, Joe Biden didn't, you know, interrupt what was going on in the Ukraine war to, you know, run defense for Mark Levin. These aren't trivial details. These are all massive, you know, red alerts that there's something odd happening with this administration. In Brian's analysis, it's all clown show. It's all punch and chewy, but, you know, it's all a distraction from, you know, what's actually happening. But the fact is, Biden didn't start a war with Iran. Obama didn't start a war with Iran, and Bush didn't start a war with Iran. And in the wars that those people did start, in the war in Iraq, for example, it was very well planned, ruthlessly carried out. And, you know, by this point, 3 weeks in, Saddam Hussein had been toppled and America had kind of achieved its immediate war aims. Where the Iraq war failed, you know, in theory, was in the reconstruction element. Of course, people who have the idea that Israel has its own plan that's separate from America's would quickly tell you that these are consistent with the greater Israel project. Actually, Iraq was never meant to succeed from the Israeli point of view. The idea is to destabilize the region, to destabilize Iraq, destabilize Syria, destabilize all of these other countries as a pretext to surround Iran and then eventually destabilize Iran, giving Israel a clear run to fulfill its ambitions of creating greater Israel, okay, or something. Now, Balesik would agree with a large part of that analysis, and I'm sure he said that sort of stuff before on New Atlas, but in his view, it's being done for U.S. supremacy with Israel only as a colonial outpost and I guess projection of American power, as opposed to Israel having any of its own ambitions or plans. My issue with this claim from Beletic and other people like him is that what other colony in history had the autonomy that Israel does? What other colony in history had the ability to bring the hegemon, right, the mother, the empire into wars? What other colony had the ability to dictate terms? What other colony had lobbying powers? What other colony had these odd figures like Witkoff and Kushner around? I actually went and asked AI. I ran several deep searches on AI saying, look through all of history and find me any empire that's had this level of autonomy and, dare I say, sovereignty. Okay? This is the key thing. It's like one of these things is not like the other. You know, in the British Empire, it didn't get the Raj calling shots. It took its orders from London. Decisions were taken in London. In this situation, it looks like we have Israel calling shots. We've got the American president on national, international television saying, yeah, I did this because if we didn't do it, Israel would have done it first. That's not to get into how they were allowed an unofficial nuclear arsenal, how they acquire those nuclear weapons in the first place. Why a blind eye is turned to spying in the White House during the Clinton era. All of these things are a matter of public record. We're just meant to ignore it all. So this is one of the issues. Nobody in India during the period of the Raj had any, or in Ghana or in any other, Gold Coast, Ivory Coast, during the European colonial era, nobody had any notion that those places were truly autonomous or that they can have their own foreign policy or their own ambitions to run their own empires or anything like that, whereas Israel does. This is even Brian would have to admit that this is a difference. Yes, we know that it wouldn't exist without American support, okay? But it doesn't act in that way, and it has never acted in that way. So the possibility must remain distinct that what he's saying and what Rory says in his article have been true up until a point, but now they've got their own plans. This is the thing. This is the difference between a dynamic analysis and a static analysis. Because it's not 1996 and it's not 2008. 2026. And certain people have their own ideas separate from the US State Department's ideas or the Pentagon's ideas. Netanyahu, love him or hate him, I hate him, by the way, has his own plans. He sees himself as a Carlylean great man of history, a Caesar figure for the Israelis. And we have to take seriously the fact that, you know, when they talk about biblical prophecies and Amalek, it doesn't matter whether I believe them or the US State Department believes them or Brian Beletic believes them. What matters is that they believe them. And if they are given license to act with, you know, almost free rein, or if they simply do not listen to the hegemon. I remember the period of Joe Biden. How many red lines, how many times did Blinken and Biden set down red lines that were brazenly crossed by the Israelis? That has also happened under Trump. But under Trump, what you're getting is total servility, a total kind of free rein, if you want, almost to a point where it's so in your face that you can't ignore it anymore. How does Brian deal with all of these things? Well, let's see if he does.
Was designed to reorganize the region into a united front against Iran, topple Iran, and not to control the Middle East, and that's that, but because it was a prerequisite for encircling both Russia and ultimately China. This is about primacy over the globe, not just primacy over the region, which is why people claiming Israel controls the United States, why this claim is absolutely, utterly ridiculous. Now, let me get into this. And again, keep in mind that if you really want to know the truth, focus on that and not how upset the things I'm about to tell you are going to make you feel. The U.S. in particular has...
But I would like to, okay, maybe there's some element of truth to what Brian's saying. Maybe that is the idea in Washington. Maybe that has been the plan in the Pentagon and in the State Department. Okay, maybe this is what was talked about in the pages of foreign policy, the RAND Corporation and all these different places. Okay. He's still overlooking the fact that other people may have other ideas, that Netanyahu may have his own agenda, and that as a man of will and purpose and of resolve, okay, and of spirit and of will to power and all those other things, that he's doing his level best to divert those plans. America may have an idea that it wants global supremacy, but Israel may have an idea that they want a greater Israel for themselves. And if they have to bleed America dry getting it and screw the US empire in the pursuit of that own smaller empire, so be it. They have served their purpose. They have served us well. Do you see the problem? Brian is not giving Israel any agency at all. It is treating it as if it's the same as the Raj doing the British Empire, or, you know, even like some African colony or something like that. But no previous colony or satrapy under the Persian Empire or the Ottoman Empire had this level of autonomy. They had certain devolved powers, okay, but they never got to set. They never had their own army. They never had their own nuclear weapons. They have never had the ability to dictate terms, to threaten American presidents or British prime ministers. This is of a different stripe. So this is a qualitative difference between Israel and previous colonies. I mean, the entire history of Canada being, you know, a subject of the British Crown. Did Canada at any point do any of this shit? No. Neither Australia or any other thing that was subject to the Crown. Let's carry on anyway.
Has been exterminating indigenous populations, stealing land, and pilfering resources for nearly 200 years before Israel ever existed. And people try to separate history into distinct chapters as if this isn't all one single continuous process. It is. This is what the U.S. has always done since it was created. That is what the U.S. has always done since it was created. It has expanded, exterminated the populations of the land it was expanding into, taking their land and extracting the resources beneath it. They did this from the East Coast all the way to the West Coast. When they ran out of people to kill and land to steal on the continental United States, they began de facto colonizing Central and South America, and they began going across the Pacific Ocean, taking one island after the other.
Yeah, all true. I don't dispute these facts, right? I don't dispute these facts. But there's also a lot of things that happened in American history between now and then. I would argue that there were several circulations of elites that took place within America. The small business of the Civil War, for example, was one circulation of elites. I would argue that between 1924 and 1964, we got a replacement of the old WASP elite with what is known as the Ellis Island Coalition. And the Ellis Island Coalition was made up of, new arrivals from Russia and elsewhere, typically to New York, who were broadly speaking Jewish, escaping pogroms and various and communism and various other things. So that was one influx. And then you had Irish, who in several large influxes, some of them escaping the famine that took place in the 19th century. But also there were several other big waves of Irish immigration, and also Italians. Many of whom were escaping fascism under Mussolini. And a lot of these people also were just seeking economic opportunity. And the New World was where it was at that time. A lot of it was just pure economic migration as well. but they changed the political makeup of the country. Okay, and they had an impact on, for example, immigration policy internally. The notion that America has just had the same elite in charge for the past 200, 300 years cannot actually, you know, withstand scrutiny and a study of the facts. Okay, the people who introduced immigration restriction in 1924 were not the same people who repealed immigration restriction in 1964. You can just look at their names. And to imagine that this does not have some impact on what happens, it is, I think, to overlook significant... So, you know, there are whole books here written on this entire process. So if it affects domestic policy, why would it not also come to affect foreign policy? Anyway, let's carry on.
From the indigenous people who live there for generations, killing them, wiping them out, or subjugating them. Hawaii was a kingdom. The U.S. toppled the monarchy, seized it, and incorporated it into the United States. They did this all the way up to Asia. They were in the process of colonizing China, along with the British, the French, and the Germans, before the World Wars. When the United States defeated the Spanish in the Spanish-American War, instead of liberating the Spanish colonies, they claimed them as their own colonies, including the Philippines. When the people in the Philippines said, no, we want independence, and they rose up in arms against U.S. colonization, the U.S. brutally put it down using mass murder, concentration camps, and systematic torture. Okay, sound familiar? Sound like things other Western nations have done in the 20th century? Infamous chapters of human history in the 20th century? That's what the U.S. does. That's what it has always done.
So I don't disagree. I don't disagree with any of these things that he's saying. What I disagree with is whether the quality and the specific aims of these things are necessarily continuous across all of this time. Because the people involved in them have changed. And with the change of the people, the actual aims have changed. He says it's simply about American global supremacy. I say there are people involved who have other ideas. And that the only way to make sense of some of the very recent events that have happened is to acknowledge the fact that there are some people who may diverge from... you know, the pure American supremacy argument. And it goes back to what I was talking about, the specific plans of Benjamin Netanyahu. And we have to also actually have a look at Israel and its development, you know, from 1948 till now. It has not always been the same sort of state. It was more left-wing. It was more secular. At various points in its history, has behaved differently, and it has become more and more radical and more extreme and more religious under Benjamin Netanyahu over the past 20 or 30 years. This is not to say that they didn't do bad things in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, because they did. What I'm saying is that the justifications, the tone, tenor, and ambition have changed through that time. People love to have the notion that all of these things were preordained or pre-planned by strange secret cults in the 19th century and things like that. Do we need that? Or do we need to say a figure like Benjamin Netanyahu and some of the people who've grown up, you know, in and around his government, Ben-Gavir and Bennett and all of these sorts of characters, have developed their own ideas of what Israel is capable of. Now, those ideas could be delusional. They could be fantasists. They could be religious nutters. But the fact is, they do have agency within what happens. And they are playing their cards, the cards that are dealt to them, okay, in the strongest possible way. But Brian, he wants to zoom out to the extent where you can't see any of that. And after a certain level, you know, he has to explain away all of this as Punch and Judy and as theatre. And I do start to wonder, the more you do that, the more you have to explain away things as quote-unquote theatre, the more your view starts to look quote-unquote conspiratorial. Think of the fallout between Starmer and Trump this past week, between all of the NATO allies, even Germany, which is a country that has been under military occupation since 1945. Okay, even Germany. Think of the divergence between all of those and the Trump admin over this Iran war, and the massive diplomatic rows, and the actual physical damage that's being done to the global economy. It's all theater. It's all just a game. Right? I mean, this is the sort of thing that schizos talk. This is the schizo frame. And for me, when Brian just has to ignore all of these things that you can see in front of your face and just say, well, it's all theater, he then starts to, like, you then have to start saying, well, hold on a second, Brian, you know, none of these new facts are relevant. It's all just preordained by this plan that was written in 1996. What plan survives contact with reality, for one? But also, like, things have changed. Things have changed since 1996. Anyway, I dare I say I start to repeat myself, but let's see what else he says.
Since the world wars, European powers exhausted their former colonial possessions, rising up, throwing off European colonization, the U.S. attempted to go into each and every single one of these countries and reassert Western control over them. In Vietnam, they killed 4 million people in the process. They ultimately failed.
Now, what he's saying is true, but he's obscuring something. Reassert Western control, he said. What I would say was happening is that America was capturing territory for itself that had previously belonged to the Europeans. That the correct way to view World War II was an American opportunist attempt to take over Europe, to militarily occupy Europe, to, you know, colonize, if you want to, or vassalize all of the European states, including Britain, which were brought under its empire. Remember, I mean, this, again, all of this stuff is written down. I've got tons of books here. Britannia Overruled. The Making of Britain, Echoes of Greatness, How Europe Became American, okay? This is not like conspiracy, this happened. Homo Americanus, Exporting the American Model, right? This book on how the Marshall Plan was used to completely overturn how business was done in Europe and had been done for centuries. Someone Else's Empire by Tom Stevenson, okay? An Ocean Apart by David Dimbleby and David Reynolds. Now, he obscures all of this detail by simply referring to it as quote-unquote the West, okay? And there are even more books I've got here. Where's the Where's America Conquers Britain by L. Denny, written in 1930? Beletic sees Europe and America as one unit, the West as one unit. Maybe maybe that's, you know, somewhat of his kind of Chinese frame on all of this. But the West is not one unit. Okay, there is actually a difference between Europe and America, and a difference between European geostrategic aims and American geostrategic aims. And, you know, his view that the kicking out of the French and the British and things like the Suez Crisis and was simply then America reasserting, quote-unquote, Western control, quote-unquote, Western, it's not quite right. It is America taking over European assets. It is America creating its own empire in the ashes of the European empires. Otherwise, you abstract things to the point where historical events have no meaning or purpose, which is, again, a schizo tendency, which I dislike. takes agency away from the men and women who are in the moment. You know, what was Anthony Eden thinking to himself during the Suez Crisis? Did he really think? Did he really think at that moment, I'm just playing a role here, you know, in a charade that ends up, you know, giving America more power? Or did he actually think, no, I'm in charge of the British Empire here? Question to be asked. So these are, I mean, I'm genuinely just articulating where I diverge from some of Brian's historical analysis here.
But they killed 4 million people in the process of trying to reassert Western control over all of Indochina, not just, you know, Indochina, not just Vietnam. They dropped more bombs on the nation of Laos, which is Thailand's neighbor to the north, Thailand, where I'm based. They dropped more bombs on Laos than there are human beings even living there. There are more unexploded munitions there today waiting to maim and kill people than there are human beings living in the country today. Let that sink in. That is how America has always done business. They openly talk about global primacy, their global international rules-based order that they lead, that benefits them. This is what they have said publicly. This is
so why is Trump absolutely flouting and destroying the international rules-based order for Israel then, Brian? At least under George Bush, there was an attempt to do it all by the book and have buy-in of Tony Blair and get in Hans Blix, the weapons inspector, and all of that. There's been no attempt to do any of that this time. It really does look more rogue. It looks rogue. And that's why people are struggling to adopt the frame that Brian has on this particular war. I have another book here. Sorry, somebody said that I do this in every video, that I look for a book and then can't bloody find it. You know, the Marxist book by Negri and by Antonio Negri, Empire, right? That talks about exactly this problem, how the rules-based international order and, you know, the human rights regime and all of that, you know, is flouted for the benefit of American supremacy and for Israel over and over and over again. And that Israel, in fact, makes a mockery of it all and exists as the exception all the time. And this undermines the legitimacy of the American empire. It undermined its own legitimacy when it continually breaks its own rules. Now it's threatening to collapse the whole order. For what? If it was about American supremacy, why would it threaten to collapse its own edifice? Its own, literally collapsing its own empire for what? Now, that can be explained if it's really to create a new empire, a greater Israel, for Netanyahu. It is not explained if you're looking at it from the point of view of U.S. supremacy. Maybe Brian can see something that Mearsheimer and every other expert can't. I'm struggling. I'm struggling to see the continuity between what's happening now and the plans written in 96 or even the plans written in 2008. In the late kind of neocon George Bush era before Obama came in.
What they have said in decades worth of policy papers. The Middle East is one of the most resource-rich regions of the world, is one of the largest areas producing and exporting energy on planet Earth. What makes you think the nation has done all of that, what I just described up until now, would not be interested in controlling the Middle East with or without Israel being there? And as President Joe Biden once famously said, if there wasn't an Israel, the US would have had to create one. And as a matter of fact, between the Americans and the British, they did create Israel. Let me continue.
He's still overlooking the fact that Israel has an unprecedented level of autonomy for what is effectively a vassal colonial state. That has not been explained. And he does not account for the fact that the people running Israel may have their own ideas, separate from the ideas of the American deep state. Because from the American point of view, even if their long-term plans are, as he's saying, for total supremacy, the timing didn't make sense. The planning hasn't made sense. the sense of kind of panic and urgency have not made any sense. All of those things can be explained if you take the lens that I have, that Israel has its own plans and has captured the Trump presidency. They do not make sense if you take his view. Where was all the planning? Where was all the manufacturing of consent? Where was the, why are the media counter-signaling it on a daily, hourly basis in real time? Why are there Iranian regime figures all over the TV? There are no Russian figures on the TV and have not been for the Ukraine war. For the Ukraine war, the regime was absolutely 100%, the US regime, I mean, and the European regime, the NATO regime, if you want, 100% moral unity. There is no moral unity on this whatsoever. And, okay, you could say, well, it's division of labor plan, but how does that work when they're diverting resources from Ukraine to fight, to defend Israel? And they're diverting resources, you know, if it's all about, you know, taking out China, why are they diverting resources from Asia, from East Asia, to the Near East? Why have they sold out all of their allies in the region, all the Gulf states, for the benefit of Israel? It's clearly weakening American power, is what I'm saying. Anyway, let's carry on.
How is what the U.S. is doing in the Middle East any different than what it did to the indigenous people of the American Midwest? We look at Israel carrying out genocide against the Palestinian people. You don't see the pattern there? You don't see that Israel is an extension of the United States rather than some foreign entity that has...
No, I disagree. I think that Israel, okay, is a relic of a bygone period which conducted brutal conquest in the way that he is saying, and that this is not an extension of US policy, but is a peculiar thing that has arisen in a country that has got more and more extreme as time has gone on. Because, why do I say this? Because America has not actually done brutal genocide and conquest in the way that he's talking about for a very long time. Even in Vietnam, it did not hold the land. Even in Korea, it did not hold the land. There has been civil rights. There has been the human rights regime. There has been the idea that America holds itself to a different standard. It was not able to hold Afghanistan. It was not able to hold Iraq. All of which don't make sense from an American point of view, but do make sense from the Israeli Greater Israel Project point of view. The war is about oil, but they're blowing up oil. You get it, right? The war is about oil, but they're blowing up oil. Iran didn't start hitting oil refineries on its own. They started hitting energy and strategic assets, important assets in the region as a tit for tat, as a retaliation against strikes on Iranian assets. And America was reportedly very upset with the Israelis for attacking oil, for hitting those refineries in Tehran that created all those billows of smoke, which suggests that they're not quite on the same page. In fact, there's all sorts of telltale signs that the Israelis and the Americans are not quite on the same page, or in fact, a lot not on the same page when it comes to this. And there's been mutual buck passing between the two as well. So I think Brian overstates the extent to which Israeli policy is simply US policy. I'm doing this, right, as a long form exercise to really hash this out, so that you in the comments can let me know what you think. Who is more persuasive here? Because I can't overlook these details. He just seems to overlook all of these details as television, basically, as a distraction. His eyes are always on that long-term plan. But beyond a certain point, what I'm saying is, it looks like he's fitting evidence to his overarching narrative and pattern already. Whereas I am trying to draw conclusions from the evidence before me. It's a very different way of thinking. Anyway, let's carry on.
Captured and corrupted the United States. Do people really not see that? They're blind. They're blind because of their own prejudice and their own bias and their own inability for self-criticism. And I don't mean they as a person, but the culture, the society that they were born into and raised within. Western civilization has been doing it for centuries beforehand. And the argument I keep seeing people make is that all empires throughout history, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, this empire, that empire, I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about Western imperialism has been continuous for centuries. They have dominated the known world and now the entire...
You're alluding between the Spanish Empire, the British Empire, the French Empire, you know, the Russian Empire even, and then the American Empire. These weren't all the same entities, and they did not work in the same way, as I have looked at countless times. As we, you know, as the work of Professor Hudson on American superimperialism, the British Empire didn't work in the same way as the American Empire. Yes, it was brutal. Yes, it did all of these things. You're right, but it's like, what is this unit of Western, quote unquote. To me, this unit is a bit of a fudge, right? It's like when people just say, quote unquote, Islamic, and yet they're not making a difference between Arab states and Iran, as an example, Shia Islam and Sunni Islam. Okay, there are different flavors of Western imperialism, and it's gone through different iterations as well. You know, the early Elizabethan explorations and the Jacobean Empire and the first British Empire, the one which actually colonized America, was not the same as the Victorian Empire in its aims, in its methods, in the way it justified itself. So he's just making too many illusions for my tastes. Maybe this is just like the kind of history autist in me or something, but this is too broad brush, in my view, from Brian, his historical overview here.
World for generations, this is one continuous process. I'm not talking about things that happened 3,000 years ago. I'm talking about everything that has led directly up to today. The British Empire, for well over two centuries before the Rothschilds, because I hear that too when I say the British Empire was doing this and the Americans simply took over. They say, well, the Jews controlled the British Empire. The Rothschilds. The British Empire was doing this for over two centuries before anyone heard the name Rothschild. Okay? Again, stop trying to blame someone else.
I mean, what I would say to that is, isn't it interesting that when these names start to enter into the British Empire lexicon, it ended up being the beginning of the end of the British Empire. In fact, I have a very interesting book here written in and around that time. It was written in like 1912, 1913, talking about, you know, why is the empire on the downward swing? People could see it happening. And there's a whole chapter about these... you know, these people, Rothschilds and various other people of that stripe, saying, well, look, they are they basically are undermining the aims, the things that the British Empire has overdone, has done over the past 200 years. They're actually changing it, and they're making different decisions, and they're fostering discontent in this colony and that colony and actually undermining it, okay? And there's, in fact, they've got another good book here about the history of those people in this country, which makes a very similar point that the British Empire actually starts going south when it becomes overly financialized, and when you start getting decisions that are made that are clearly not in British interests. Okay, and you could say, you could argue that the American Empire, which I think is in its death throes, is in its downward spiral, that history has repeated itself. And now we've come to the point where, once again, these people have come to the fore and they've come to dominate institutions and so on. And lo and behold, they've run the empire into the ground. So when the British Empire was actually being run for itself, yes, everything he's saying is right. It was brutal and it was, you know, it tyrannized other places and it plundered their resources and so on. What I'm saying is that you cannot also overlook the fact that there's a correlation between these people entering into the elite layer and then the rapid death spiral of the British Empire. Now we're seeing a very similar thing. American assets being basically wasted for a project that does not have obvious American interests at its heart. That's why most of the public don't support it. So anyway, and this is not, again, it's a matter of record. There's tons of people who talk about this. Major General Richard Hilton is another one. You know, John Bagot Glubb is another one who talks about what happens in late empire when you start bringing in diversity into the elite class and what happens then to the imperial project under those conditions.
Find a mirror, look in the mirror, and make room for self-criticism. Again, is the truth more important or your pride and your ego and your emotions? Western civilization was for centuries bent on brutal racist empire building, and it continues today. Israel is just one of many cogs created perpetuating this process. The Americans and before them, the British, openly said that they have to civilize the world because the world is full of barbarians and savages. They're incapable of doing it themselves. And you will even hear people to this day defend British and American imperialism as bringing civilization to all of these places, that all of everything that we enjoy today is a result and a result and benefit of Western imperialism. You'll hear people make that argument.
All right. I think that I'll end up repeating myself. It is not that Brian is totally wrong with what he's saying. A lot of the things he's saying are factual, and I don't disagree with them. What I'm saying is that he's too zoomed out, and he is not looking at the makeup of the actual elite making decisions, and then what happens in terms of the success or failure rates of empires when you get different decision makers at the top. Okay? You could argue that the appearance of Witkoff and Kushner, okay, is the beginning of the end of the American empire as a symptom. Okay, just as in the late 19th century, the appearance of these banking elites who emerged, okay, was the beginning of the end of the British Empire. As a matter, I mean, all you need to do is read the people who were around at the time and what they were saying about the makeup of that elite. Not just Carlyle, but many, many other people I have here as well. One of my little hobby horses, one of the things I take great interest in, is trying to understand the causes of the decline of the British Empire. Okay? And people were seeing the writing on the wall as early as the 1880s, 1870s even. Okay, with the emergence of Disraeli, even. Okay. Anyway, there is another thing I want to look at before we wrap things up here. And that is the reply of Rory. Like I said, he's given me a whole reply. He's called himself Red King here on Substack. And he said in a tweet, if the U.S. is an empire, Israel is better understood as a strategic outpost of that empire. As for Tucker, he's signaling a shift in how the U.S. plans to use Israel. And I quoted him and said, sovereign is he who decides the exception. And when Israel is every exception, it is natural, therefore, to conclude it is sovereign. He says, for some, the U.S.-Israeli war, and I'm not going to read this word for word, okay, I'm just going to try to get the essence of what he's saying and give my responses. He maintains that Tucker Carlson and his ilk are a counter gang, okay, This was something discussed on Scrump and Evelyn's channel. It comes from the work of Frank Kitson, Caleb Maupin, who's a very interesting Marxist thinker who I've had on the channel a number of times, talk a lot about counter gangs. And I do not dispute the use of counter gangs, okay? And anyway, him saying that prompted an exchange with me. And he says it crystallized a broader disagreement about sovereignty, empire, and the U.S.-Israeli relationship. I argue, through the tongue-in-cheek framing of copium, that I want figures like Carlson to represent genuine American primacy, and I describe my position as a realist one, and America run for itself rather than run for Israel, and Israel behaves like a normal nation state. And then he replied that if the U.S. is an empire, Israel is better understood as a strategic outpost. I then use the, you know, sovereign is who decides the exception. Now, what he's saying is that I basically twisted Schmidt there because it is he who decides the exception, not the exception itself. But then when we look at the key decision makers, okay, in this case, it's Donald Trump taking advice from Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, in constant contact with Benjamin Netanyahu, who visited the White House six or seven times in the run-up to this war. Who is deciding the exception? Who is deciding the exception? Why are exceptions made even for Kushner and Witkoff to be there at all? How is it tolerated? This is the exception I'm talking about. And it strikes me that the reason that this can happen is because they are the ones who are doing the deciding. But anyway, he says that, you know, I've kind of rhetorically twisted Schmidt there, and that actually, you know, what Schmidt is asking, who can authorize extraordinary measures, who can block or reverse them, who controls the instruments and so on. And what I'm saying is, actually, increasingly, it is directly these people. The Trump administration has the highest concentration of ardent, hardcore Zionists, whether people who are, you know, directly eligible for Israeli citizenship, people who have served in the IDF, okay, or people who are of the kind of nut job Christian Zionist stripe, like Mike Huckabee or Pete Hegseth, or these sorts of characters. It has a very high concentration of these sorts of decision makers. Okay, so they are the decision makers. Formally and legally, they are the decision makers, and they are deciding the exception. So that's how I would argue. That's how I would argue this. He's saying I inverted it. Maybe I phrased it clumsily or whatever. But I would maintain that the decision maker themselves always consistently decides for Israel as the exception, which suggests to me that it is the one doing the deciding in the first place. Okay. Second, the Marxist view of this, that I invited a Marxist counter-argument to what I was saying on a stream. And, you know, we're going back to Communist Manifesto, and that the bourgeoisie, through the exploitation of the world market, is given a cosmopolitan character, et cetera, et cetera. You know, then he turns to Lenin's imperialism. And I'm just going to cut to his conclusion here, because this stream will go on forever if I don't wrap things up soon. He says, what I treat as evidence of Israeli sovereignty, repeated policy exceptions and strategic indulgence fits within this structure of imperial hierarchy. Imperial systems rule through intermediaries, client states, outposts, and protégés that retain local autonomy and receive disproportionate subsidy. Such autonomy and subsidy remain compatible with the patron retaining ultimate authority over finance, arms, and exceptional measures. The pattern repeated exception fits this structure. It means the means through which imperialism is exercised, not evidence that the client has become sovereign. I mean, my challenge to Rory and to all of the other people watching this, find me 20 examples of a colony in history that has exerted as much, as commanded as much, as many resources, that and has dictated terms more than Israel has. Okay, it strikes me that even in the long imperial history of the West, this is a pretty exceptional set of, even within all of those other examples, I just don't see any parallel to what we're seeing here. You know, go back to the Raj, go back to the African colonial outposts. When have we seen this sort of stuff in the past? Give me examples. Give me empirical data to back this up. Because otherwise, it looks to me like you're again fitting facts to the overall theory. I like to draw conclusions from facts. I just don't see these autonomous... I mean, the closest thing I can think of is probably something like Cecil Rhodes, right? Something like Cecil Rhodes, right? You could say it's probably the closest thing you could get. But I mean, I would say that Israel's power, Israel's autonomy is way greater than Cecil Rhodes' was, even at the height of his power. Now he has this section on Israel as an aircraft carrier. He says, we have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. Our real task is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity, says George Kennan back in 1948. The phrase Israel as an aircraft carrier captures the strategic logic at issue. When Alexander Haig described Israel as an equivalent of an unsinkable American aircraft carrier in the Middle East, he was describing not a sovereign power directing the United States, but a strategic asset embedded within the American power projection. Yes, but I will take you back. That was 1948. It's 2026 now. Hell of a lot of stuff has happened between now and then. Including quite a huge amount of money spent on behalf of these people. And a kind of world, you want to put it this way, a great man of history, Benjamin Netanyahu, arising and trying to lead his people quite literally to the promised land. My language, not even accidental there. He's on the record of saying that he wants to do this. And I meant to ignore all of this as just a kind of front for American colonial power. I mean, what happens when the aims of this great man, of this Israeli exception, starts to go against what the hegemon wants, or what the people in the U.S. empire want, or the people running the U.S. empire want? Who ends up getting their way and who ends up having to back down? And so far, as far as I can see, Israel steps over every red line, breaks every single rule, and nobody dares to tell them, pipe down. Okay? At the moment. That wasn't true back in the day. And what Rory does is he basically goes through examples of when American presidents stood up to Israel. The fact is, American presidents haven't truly stood up to Israel since JFK was shot. He was probably the last one. And Nixon, to be fair, Nixon as well had a little bit of back and forth. But apart from that, don't forget, Nixon was brought down. JFK was shot, which was, you can draw your own conclusions about that. What I'm saying is that certainly in the past 20 or 30 years, since Clinton, right? Since Clinton, there's been very little pushback. Probably the most pushback has been from Barack Obama. Okay, and look at how much he was demonized and hated, and look at how he was used to bring the rise of Donald Trump and MAGA. And now a lot of people are saying, well, maybe MAGA was a psyop from the stars. I don't know about that, but certainly as MAGA as it stands right now, MAGA doesn't stand for anti-war. It doesn't stand for any of the things that people believed that Trump stood for. All of his allies have been sidelined. Marjorie Taylor Greene, kicked out and so on. Now MAGA stands for Mark Levin and Ben Shapiro and all of these sorts of people who are in Laura Luma and literally psychopathic Zionists. That's what's happened. How has this happened? Again, and it's been so unpopular against all the runs of play. And I would say it's happened because there's somebody who wants it more. Somebody who wants his plan more. And that man was Netanyahu. Anyway, now he goes on to talk about the Israel lobby thesis and about Mir Shimer. And he says, if Israel was sovereign over the United States, American policymakers would lack the capacity to impose major reversals or constraints contrary to Israeli preferences. The historical record shows they do possess that capacity and have exercised it. Yeah, but when, Rory? When? When did they exercise that last? You have to go back to Eisenhower and Truman. Like I said, JFK was the last one to properly stand up to them. Little bit Obama as well. The capacity is there in theory, but in practice, they end up getting their own way. In practice, they end up against all rational, normal incentives of American geostrategic positioning, American world status and prestige, American moral legitimacy, the MAGA base, the American voting public, even mainstream media opinion, all of those things rode over roughshod for the benefit of Israel for this war. And I am not convinced that by going back to look at what George Kennan said in 1948, that you've adequately dealt with the sheer extent of the exception. So the strongest card available to the Israeli primacy thesis is not Schmidt's definition, but the historical cases where, okay, so he anticipates what I've just said there, which is, times where, American opposition was overridden by Israeli interests, quote unquote. Okay. And, he says, there are been all these different cases, you know, from Kennedy onwards. So he's acknowledging this. The Gaza situation presents further evidence of Israeli defiance during the Biden admin. Red lines were crossed, the Rafah offensive. You know, now they've snuck into Lebanon and so on. He says three distinctions are necessary. So he's going to try to deal with what he sees as the strongest argument, which I've already put forth, okay? He says three distinctions are necessary. First, the Dimona case may not be a failure of American power at all. Kennedy's non-proliferation pressure was real, but Nixon's acquiescence through the 1969 understanding with Golda Meir reflects more of a strategic calculation than weakness. A nuclear-armed Israel capable of threatening any regional power that might challenge the American-managed order and its supply chains is a more valuable asset than a non-nuclear one. This matters regarding the current war. Yeah, but also, look, if you've got the biggest guns in the world, you just entrust them to the regional colonial leader. When did that happen before? What if they start turning those guns on you? This is the whole court, the much talked about Samson option. That seems to be, in pure Machiavellian terms, creating a genuine rival castle, that ends up threatening to take the whole thing, which may be what we're watching play out. So that would be what I would say to this counter. It kind of smells copy to me. This matters regarding the current war. Israel's geostrategic position astride the eastern Mediterranean, within striking distance of the Persian Gulf and capable of projecting force towards the Strait of Hormuz, makes its deterrent capacity relevant. Israel has been bombed every single day for the past 17 days. Okay. Deterrent, schmesperrent, as far as I'm concerned. Deterrent what? Deterrent, I mean, literally, Israel is being hammered by Hezbollah up in the north, by the Houthis down in the south, and by Iran every single day with massive one-ton ballistic missiles every single day for 17 days. Deterrent? It's not a deterrent, is it? Anyway, let's carry on. A nuclear Israel extends deterrence across the region without requiring permanent American deployment. On this reading, the Dimona case is better understood as a client state acting in a direction that suited the patron in the long term, who then formalized the outcome once the strategic logic became clear. This is the opposite of sovereignty. A truly sovereign Israel would be able to act against American interests and face no consequences. I would argue that the sovereign Israel has acted against American interests continually and faced no consequences. I would argue that has happened again and again and again and again. And every single time you get some corrupt shithead in power who turns a blind eye or gives them a pass. They never face any consequences. And despite the fact that red lines set down by many different presidents have been crossed repeatedly, that the official US policy has repeatedly been violated without consequence in Israel. What the nuclear case actually shows is that Israel acted, America objected, reassessed, and henceforth acted as if the outcome served it. Yeah, you could just say it's American cope. You could just say that people in the American leadership are compromised by this. This would be another explanation. Marx's mechanism from Capital thus operates as a supplement rather than the main explanation. The reason Nixon would formalize giving concessions to Israel without diplomatic political cost is that the structural conditions made it easy to absorb a decision that American grand strategy had already made for itself. Second, the distinction between tactical defiance and structural dependence is crucial. Israel has succeeded in resisting specific American demands on settlements, Rafah, and on the pace of military operations. But in each case, it did so within a framework of dependence. American arms, American diplomatic cover at the UN, American financial guarantees. Right, Rory, but if you watch Israeli hardcore Zionists like Caroline Glick or listen to Ben Shapiro for long enough, you quickly understand that they see this as a problem and they want shots of American dependence. They want to go it alone eventually. They want to cut off the umbilical cord and stand as the great Israel. That's their ambition. So would you deny that they have a separate ambition over and above or separate from what the American hegemon may want? And that these two things come into conflict, and that maybe historically various administrations were able to keep it in check, but now we've got an administration that does nothing to keep it in check whatsoever, because maybe they've got something over Donald Trump's head, or maybe Donald Trump was just always an agent of theirs from the very start, which is what some people argue. Trump was the first Jewish president. Former Israeli ambassador puts it more succinctly: the nature of the relationship between Israel and the United States is asymmetrical. We are kind of a client state. Third, to address my argument head on, successful defiance of a patron does not transfer sovereignty to the client. The Shmittian question is not who wins individual confrontations, but who commands the final means of exceptional decision. I mean, we're 17 days into the war here. Even after Israel acquired nuclear weapons against American wishes, it remained dependent on American arms transfers, American veto power at the UN, American management of the regional order within which it operates. The parallel is instructive. France developed an independent nuclear deterrent in direct defiance of American preferences, withdrew from NATO's integrated military command in 1966, pursued a foreign policy designed to assert independence from Washington. This did not mean that France had become sovereign over the United States or that American power had been subordinated to French interests. Structural relation. Yeah, but France is a separate country from America. But like, if France could subsist without American aid, so that this is also a little bit of a disanalogy, I would say. The structural relationship, American Security Guarantee, Atlantic Alliance, dollar-denominated trade, remained intact beneath the surface of tactical defiance. Israel's case is analogous, with the added caveat that French independence was self-financing, whereas Israeli strategic economy was financed with American money. The patron's failure to enforce a specific demand does not abolish the structural relationship any more than a failure of to discipline a wayward employee abolishes the employment relation. What cases of defiance demonstrate is that American leverage over Israel has structural limits. They do not demonstrate that sovereignty has been transferred. All right, but show me a war that was started by France that then had America come in to bail it out. Or just show me any action from France that is in any way analogous to what we've seen from Netanyahu in the past 10 years. I don't see France doing any of that stuff, to be honest. And then finally, the counter-gangs part on Tucker Carlson. We can now return to the point from which this essay began, the question of Tucker Carlson, the meaning of the elite dissent within American foreign policy. The original tweet described Carlson and similar figures as a counter-gang. The phrase was not intended as a rhetorical insult, but as a technical description drawn from the counterinsurgency doctrine of Frank Kitson, low intensity operations. We don't need to go into Kitson there. This dynamic is not confined to colonial counterinsurgency. Imperial systems generate conflict within the ruling class over the management of hegemony, above all in periods of strategic recalibration. Such conflicts do not indicate a rupture with empire. They mark an attempt to adapt imperial strategy to change conditions while preserving the structure of power. Empires have long governed through clients, buffers, and protégés, and forward position rather than through direct rule alone. Rome governed Judea at points through client arrangements. Yes, but when did Judea dictate Roman foreign policy? When did Judea have autonomy enough to start its own wars and to make demands of the Roman emperor? British policy treated Palestine and Zionism as instruments within a wider imperial design. In both cases, the local formation could be privileged and useful without becoming sovereign over the imperial center. Right, well, it didn't happen back then. What I'm saying is through the actions and ambitions of Netanyahu and the Israelis, they have achieved this. They have actually managed somehow to inculcate themselves in the highest decision-making units of power within America to force the hegemon to take decisions that are not actually in its interests. For example, this war. Figures such as Carlson should be understood in this context. Their criticism of particular policies reflects a dispute over how American power should be exercised, not whether it should exist. That's true. What presents itself as dissent may also be read as an attempt to reverse the political and public-facing form through which imperial policy is legitimized. Disagreement within the foreign policy apparatus does not demonstrate that sovereignty lies elsewhere. It demonstrates that the direction of empire remains a question internal to the American ruling bloc. I don't disagree with that. And I would agree that Tucker Carlson is trying to course correct for the American empire. He's trying to help out the American ruling class. And he's fighting a WASP rearguard action against the people who support Israel. He wants a different direction, much like John Mearsheimer and many other people. What I'm saying, and what Tucker Carlson is saying, is that he's lost that argument, and the Ben Shapiro's of this world have won that argument. The debate surrounding the war and also, as it comes to this particular debate here, the fact they've won that argument means that, as things stand, you have a separate set of interests, a set of interests that are not American, that are foreign to America, dictating what America should do. This, I think, is a very difficult thing to overlook. Otherwise, what is even the argument? what is even Tucker Carlson and Neil Shimer, all these people saying? I would agree that they don't want to see an end to American dominance or to American empire per se. They have no, you know, they have no beef with the notion that America could be number one. What they have a specific problem with is Israel trying to dictate the terms and the shape and the direction that takes. I think they've got a point. These people don't. The debate surrounding the war in Iran reveals some important, but something important, but not what I suggest. It unfolds against the background of Israel's genocide in Gaza, which has exposed a division within the American elite over how far imperial commitments can be sustained at political and strategic cost. It does not demonstrate that Israel commands American policy. I think it does. I think it does. I think that, and I also think it's rogue. I think it's actually a departure from what we've seen, as I said right at the start, that something in the Trump admin has gone rogue, that it's been captured, and that now you have Netanyahu directly dictating foreign policy. And we've been told that by Marco Rubio, by Trump himself, and by Pete Hegseth. They have literally put the finger of blame on Witkoff and Kushner. And he literally said, we did this because if we didn't do it, Israel would do it, suggesting they don't have control over what Israel does. It unfolds against the backdrop of the genocide. It does not demonstrate, et cetera. The decisive point remains simple. Israel's exceptional status is real. The question is, what explains it? My argument is not that Israel lacks influence, leverage, or privilege, but that influence, leverage, and privilege do not amount to sovereignty. The better explanation is imperial strategy and domestic bloc formation within the metropole rather than the subordination of the metropole to agents of a foreign state. My very quick rebuttal to that is that if you have a look at the sheer cost of this war to the American imperial project, to American global interest, to America's image in the world as the number one power, it has dealt it really quite mortal blows, perhaps even fatal blows, as per my video from 2 days ago. For what? For the colonial outpost of Israel? It makes a lot more sense if you say Trump's gone rogue, he's been captured by Netanyahu, and then Netanyahu has separate ambitions over and above and contrary to what American power wants to do. And the reason it's prepared to write off the American empire, actually it needs to go away if they're going to fulfill their ambitions about being a superpower in the Middle East, a regional superpower, the Greater Israel Project. That is what I think is actually happening here. You may take a different view. Maybe you agree with Rory. Maybe you agree with Brian Balesic. I've been talking for an hour and a half. I still haven't finished this. I've been very slow on this cigar. I need to clear my throat like Cool and the Gang. Remember that? Let me clear my throat. I hope you enjoy this. It was a much longer video than usual, but I wanted to address it. I promised I would. I've done it. Catch you all next time. Bye, everyone. Oh, yeah. Bye, Foundations of Shakespeare. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.